This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome. Welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. Coming up on Africa News Tonight...
Extremely important from regional sources, from international sources, from the private sector, extremely important. But the actors must remember that this assistance must be anchored in a vision of constitutionalism, in a vision of restoring the rule of law, and a vision of putting Sudan back on a democratic path.
That's Paul Nantulia, a research associate at the Africa Center for Strategic Studies, on the need to combine economic reform in Sudan with political democratization. Details coming up also. In southern Ethiopia, residents of the Sidama zone voted today in what they call a historic referendum. And police in Zimbabwe used tear gas and water cannons today to break up an opposition rally. We'll have these stories and more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story: in southern Ethiopia, residents of the Sidama zone voted today in what they call a historic referendum. I asked our Horn of Africa reporter in Ethiopia's capital, Addis Ababa, Iskander Ferreu, about the significance of the referendum.
Sidama is the fifth largest ethnic group in the country, population-wise, and they have been demanding for statehood for so long now. As you know, Ethiopia has 9 regional states, most of them demarcated along ethnic lines. The Sidama people have been demanding for statehood to form, you know, the 10th regional state in Ethiopia. And for them, the fact that they have been allowed, you know, to decide their destiny through a referendum is, you know, a big achievement. And they call it, you know, a historic day, you know. I have been able to talk to some of the voters today, and they said they consider it as if they are born again. So it's historic for them because they have been demanding for this for so long. The Southern Nations and Nationalities region, which Sidama has been, you know, a part of, consists of about 66 nations and nationalities, and Sidama has more population than all of them. So they believe, you know, they deserve, you know, statehood, so that, you know, they can have more voice and representation at the federal level, and also more economic power as well.
So, Iskander, what is the significance of this referendum as far as Ethiopia is concerned, the whole country?
You know, Ethiopia was a country that did not allow, you know, such democratic practices to take place, you know, in the past 27 years. So it's, you know, a new thing for the country as well. By the way, it's the first referendum in the history of the country as well. If I can quote from what the Prime Minister, the Ethiopian Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed, tweeted, he said, this is an expression of the democratization path Ethiopia has set out on. This is what he said. And in an interview with VOA, Speaker of the Sidama People's Council, Salomon Lera, also said the same thing. He believes the fact that they have been allowed to decide on their destiny through a referendum is the result of, you know, the ongoing reforms in the country. He told me this was not possible in the past 27 years, and many sacrifices have been made.
So, Iskander, the referendum initially was scheduled for July, and at that time it sparked violence in which about, according to Amnesty International, 170 people died. Was it peaceful this time around?
It was according to, you know, the Civic Society Observers Group that gave a press conference today in Hawassa, it has been peaceful, except some irregularities. They said, you know, the whole process has been peaceful and very participatory. This is the assessment of, you know, the Civic Society Observers Group, which is, you know, an independent group that has been observing, you know, the referendum in the Sidama zone.
That was Horn of Africa reporter in Ethiopia's capital, Addis Ababa, Iskander Ferreu, talking about the historic referendum today in Ethiopia's southern Sidama zone. So, Sudanese Finance Minister Ibrahim Al-Badawi says the country needs $5 billion to avoid economic collapse. Since late 2017, Sudan has suffered a currency and fiscal crisis that has led to hyperinflation, a collapse of the banking system, shortages of basic goods such as fuel. Sudan has no access to funds from international financial institutions. During Prime Minister Abdullah Hamdok's visit to Brussels last week, he asked the EU to push for Sudan's removal from the U.S. list of state sponsors of terrorism to facilitate international lending to his country. Paul Nantulia, a research associate at the Africa Center for Strategic Studies, spoke with VOA senior analyst Mohamed Al-Shinawi about the need to combine economic reform in Sudan with political democratization.
I think it's imperative that the new administration should not limit its reform agenda merely to economic reform and to getting outside economic assistance. As important as that is, they should not lose sight of the need for democratic and constitutional reforms as demanded by the Sudanese people. If they minimize this process simply to securing assistance from outside while retaining the authoritarian structures that Sudan has had since independence, it's a model that hasn't worked. It hasn't worked in other situations such as South Sudan, Zimbabwe, and Democratic Republic of Congo. So I think the best way out is not to lose sight of the democratization agenda.
What can the international community offer Sudan to counter its challenges?
I think what the international community needs to is to support, enable, and assist the larger democratization process in Sudan. It's important to remember that Sudan's economics are rooted in what was essentially an authoritarian system that damaged the country's institutions, militarized the country, looted the country's resources and public assets. And because there was lack of accountability and parliament and all these independent institutions were not working, the economic planning was arbitrary. It was characterized by patronage and serious financial and fiscal misconduct. So the international community should not just be content in merely extending aid and assistance just because Bashir is gone. And we've seen that this new government, it has goodwill, but we all understand that it faces monumental challenges moving forward. And many in the new setup would like to retain as much of the old system as they can. These are very powerful individuals. And so this is a fragile transition. So international partners should understand that their support must be premised on pushing forward on the democratic front.
What the government spends 60 to 70% of its budget on defense and security. Placing new limits on these forces should also be an economic priority. However, Prime Minister Hamdok hinted that spending would only be redirected away from defense and security when the government has reached a peace agreement with armed groups from the Blue Nile, Darfur, and South Kordofan provinces. What do you make of that?
This should tell us immediately that the military component of the transitional government still holds tremendous political power. Within that component, the most powerful faction, certainly in the minds of many Sudanese, is still loyal to the commander of the Rapid Response Forces, General Mohamed Hamdan Dagalo, also known as Hemeti. Many believe that he continues to wield significant influence behind the scenes. But this should not be surprising. Post-transitional contexts from authoritarian systems to democracy are notoriously very, very difficult, with members of the old order trying to preserve as much of it as they can. So we can be sure that elements of the old security establishment might not be too pleased with the Prime Minister's decision to open negotiations with all of Sudan's rebel groups. It is worth noting that Sudan's defense and security budget and its intelligence budget were routinely abused and used as part of Bashir's extensive patronage network. So reaching peace with the rebels and reducing the defense budget might shake up and weaken those networks. It's always a danger, and it's one that the Prime Minister must be keenly aware of.
Sudan has also asked the European Union to push for its removal from the U.S. list of state sponsors of terrorism. How would that move facilitate international lending to Sudan?
What is required in the Sudan is a social and political transformation that places the country on a democratic footing. Sudan is certainly facing economic challenges. It is certainly facing financial challenges. But I think the most important thing is to reform the country's institutions. Because if outside assistance comes in into an authoritarian environment, an environment that is rife with impunity and with misconduct, then even that aid will not help ultimately at the end of the day. Financial assistance, yes, it's extremely important from regional sources, from international sources, from the private sector, extremely important. But the actors must remember that this assistance must be anchored in a vision of constitutionalism, in a vision of restoring the rule of law, and a vision of putting Sudan back on a democratic path.
That was Paul Nantulia, a research associate at the Africa Center for Strategic Studies, speaking with VOA senior analyst Mohamed Al-Shenawi. Police in Zimbabwe used tear gas and water cannons today to break up an opposition rally in the capital, Harare. As Columbus Mavunga reports from Harare, the opposition says President Emmerson Mnangagwa is shutting down political space, not unlike his predecessor, Robert Mugabe.
Sirens wailed Wednesday as police tried to disperse supporters of the Movement for Democratic Change as they waited to hear an address by party leader Nelson Chamisa. But the group did not budge. A few minutes after Chamisa entered the offices, police fired tear gas to disperse approximately 200 opposition supporters. Those that resisted tear gas were assaulted. Bystanders such as 24-year-old soft drink vendor Runyararo Mazinira with her 2-year-old child on the back were not spared as she sustained injuries from the police assaults. Before we even managed to leave on their orders, they started beating us with the baton sticks. They even assaulted my child. My hand is heavy and numb because of the assholes. They even beat me on the face. There is nothing I can do to them, but I feel very pained by what they did to me. There is no crime I committed as I was just selling my wares, says Mazinira. Chamisa was set to make what he called Hope of the Nation address, which police later said had not been sanctioned. But MDC Vice President Tendai Biti said that fact should not matter.
We don't accept this. We're not a terrorist organization. We're not a fascist organization. Since 2017, we've seen the closure of our political space because of Emmerson Mnangagwa. And we don't accept this. We say no to fascism. We say no to madness.
Biti said he hoped leaders of the Southern African Development Community, such as South African President Cyril Ramaphosa, see what is happening in Zimbabwe. MDC spokesman Nkululeko Sibanda said the party would continue to challenge the legitimacy of President Emmerson Mnangagwa, whom they accused of stealing last year's elections from Chamisa. The police actions on Wednesday come as Mnangagwa's government appeals to the United States and Europe to lift sanctions imposed on Zimbabwe's leadership starting in 2002 for political repression and election rigging. Mnangagwa, who came to power in 2017, says he's different from his predecessor and former ally, the late Robert Mugabe, whose regime was continuously accused of cracking down his critics. Columbus Mavunga for VOA News, Harare.
Zimbabwe's economic downturn continues to plunge more and more citizens into poverty, as a new assessment by an international organization reveals. Adigando gives us more on the development.
International Labour Organization, ILO, Country Director Hopoleng Pororo told a recent workshop in Bulawayo that poverty has reached alarming levels in Zimbabwe, with 65% of adults earning US$100 or less per month. The ILO workshop was designed to co-create design of workspace for informal economy traders. Pororo said the levels of informality in Africa are quite high, with Zimbabwe having one of the highest rates. Economic analysts, however, say the figure is actually lower than the ILO estimates. Economic analyst Dumisani Sibanda weighs in.
When they say $100, You would say it's an underestimation. When you look at the effective figure in terms of earning capacity, people are earning about $60.
Observers say those most impacted live in rural areas where there is very little economic activity due to the ongoing drought. Dumsani Nkomo of Habakkuk Trust, a Christian non-governmental organization with projects covering Matabeleland, and says poverty is hitting hard and deep.
The level of poverty in most of the areas that we're working, it is very, very acute. You find that in most of the areas, people have been affected by severe drought. They have to rely on handouts from non-governmental organizations, from the Department of Social Welfare. This has actually accentuated or deepened the levels of poverty in areas such as Matobo, Nkai, Vulilima, Mangwe, and most of Matabeleland North and South, where people depend on remittances from people that work in South Africa.
Ngomo says that the situation has changed for the worse for many families because of recent events.
But again, because of conditions in South Africa, where a lot of people are affected by xenophobia, are also affected by the economic downturn globally, you find that there is increasing poverty. And the face of this poverty is the feminization of poverty, because you find that a lot of households, especially in Matabeleland South, are female-headed. So this is what we have seen. There is extreme poverty.
While the whole country is dealing with efforts to stabilize currency chaos, Nkomo says his organization deals with people who have no access to either the RTGS dollar or to the US dollar. He says the issue of poverty is also affecting effective citizen participation in decision-making.
Because people would rather choose to queue for food than to attend a public meeting on a pertinent social or public issue.
The government says it is working to improve people's lives, and that one strategy is creating favorable conditions for the informal sector to thrive. Analysts, however, say informalizing the economy further is hardly the solution Zimbabwe needs. Instead, they call for efficient management of national resources and well-crafted macroeconomic policy. Reporting for VOA, this is Adi Gondo.
A new study says shocking numbers of Ugandan school children are unable to comprehend basic reading and math, reflecting an alarming decline in the quality of education, mainly by government-run schools. Reporter Mugume Davis Rwakarinji files this report.
The survey by the Twaweza NGO, which advocates for improvement of education in East Africa, was conducted a year ago to assess basic skills. Titled, Are Our Children Learning? It involved children ages 6 to 16. Lead researcher Mary Goretti Nakabugo, who heads Uwezo Uganda, which conducted the study, says researchers interviewed more than 45,000 children in 32 districts. It found only 33% of children from primary 3 to 7 levels were able to read and comprehend a basic story at primary 2 level, compared with about 40% in a similar study conducted in 2015.
Most of them achieve that skill when they're in primary 6. I mean, having gone through 6 years of primary education. If you look at, for example, primary 5, you have only about 39% of children who are able to read and understand at primary 2 level, meaning that you still have about 60% who are seated in a primary 5 classroom, but actually they are not even yet at a primary 2 level.
The new study found that only 22% of students in government-owned schools had that reading competence, compared with 44% of those in private schools. Children study up to primary 7 in Uganda to complete their elementary level of education. Nakabogo says improper education at this level could affect performance in further education. She says higher teacher-student ratios is one main cause of poor education. The research also points at a lack of basic education infrastructure. For example, the ratio of people to toilet ratios stands at 1 to 58 as compared to the required 1 to 40. Over 50% of schools surveyed found they had bacteria-causing diseases in their drinking water. Mother of 9, Esther Kanabi, also blamed poverty. She says sometimes her children spend a day at school without a meal.
I cannot afford to buy the scholastic materials for those children. And food is also another problem. I cannot afford. They come back and ask, Mommy, give us food. Mommy, give us food. I tell them, today I've failed. Go and sleep. It is what I tell them. Sometimes they go on crying. Sometimes when I get some posho, I just make for them porridge and they come back and take that.
Kedros Turyagyenda, Uganda's Director of Education Standards, says the government is well aware of the problem. The
report has written, have really confirmed what we have seen before, which is good because that's a validation of other information that we've had. However, we did not sit down when we saw what had come out of these reports, and a number of interventions have already been put in place, especially to try and lift the literacy which this report was focusing on. And this literacy can only be lifted if it starts from the beginning.
The research recommended improvement of early education as one way to improve learning. For VOA News, I am Mugume Davis Ruakarinyi in Kampala, Uganda.
Ghana is regarded as a West African hub of invention, with growing numbers of young people looking at local solutions to local problems. In December, Ghana is hosting two conferences on innovation and technology. Stacey Na takes a look at some of the inventors in this report from Accra.
Al-Hassan Baba Muniru, co-founder of the Recycle Up company, wants to clean up the natural environment in Ghana. But he also wants to educate, empower, and support young people to pursue conservation and to make money while doing it. At the December Innovation Africa Summit in Accra, he plans to advocate for more support for young inventors, especially those looking to do green business.
Even while we are in school, we are already kind of entrepreneurial. So for me, I can't be able to do a formal job, but the freedom of, you know, being able to bring my own ideas, you know, into action and to really, you know, take charge of doing something practical and something also which makes society better, you know, it's much more fulfilling.
Part of Recycle Up's work includes collecting plastic from schools to sell to people like Nelson Boateng, whose company mixes it with sand to create bricks. Muniru and Boateng walk through the factory in the outskirts of Accra, where plastic from across the city is shredded, melted, mixed, and then moulded into bricks to be used for roads, pavements, and buildings. Boateng, who also manufactures plastic bags, says the bricks are his way of helping to clean up the environment and to provide jobs. But while Ghana is seeing a spurt in innovation, he says the country needs a lot more infrastructure to support environmentally friendly business.
For innovations in Ghana, it's very, very difficult. If you don't really have the heart, you lose hope. Because, honestly speaking, when I was doing my poly bag, that is polluting the environment, I was having a lot of money. I have money. There wasn't any problem. When I started this, when you go to the bank, they don't know this. They want something that the money will be flowing, not something new people don't know. And not something that you are trying to save the environment. Nobody will mind you on that.
Supporting local technology startups is expected to be discussed at another December conference in Accra, the second annual Ghana Tech Summit. Ghanaian inventor Andrew Kwal is working to ease the burden on hospitals with technology that allows pharmacies to diagnose and monitor chronic and tropical diseases. He says African healthcare sectors like Ghana's are ripe for innovative solutions.
I think it's growing in the right direction, and you're getting, I think the climate is good. You've got a good mix of local talent, local experience, even expats coming in, seeing Ghana as a good point to start. So that also work, and you've got like what we call the brain gain, like the diaspora, like people like myself, schooled US, like coming back, seeing, trying to like bring innovation in country.
While both public and private sectors are backing innovation, entrepreneurs hope to see a swell of support from the Innovation Africa and Ghana Tech Summits. Stacey Knott for VOA News, Accra.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington.
Hello, this is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, the fall of the Berlin Wall 30 years ago marked the end of the Cold War and brought about a number of significant changes in Africa. We'll take a closer look on the next Straight Talk Africa.
Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.